Hello, this is Ron Falk for the Department of Medicine at the University of North Carolina. Welcome to the Chair's Corner. Today, we welcome Dr. Patrick Nachman, who is the Covington Distinguished Professor of Medicine in our Division of Nephrology and Hypertension. He also serves as the Deputy Director of the UNC Kidney Center. Patrick Nachman specializes in the care of patients with immune-mediated kidney diseases, or glomerular diseases, as they're called. He leads numerous clinical trials that investigate treatment options for a number of these conditions, and he is very well known for his work on ANCA glomerulonephritis or ANCA-associated vasculitis. Today, our focus is going to be on the treatment of ANCA vasculitis with a drug called rituximab or Rituxan. Welcome, Patrick Nachman.
Thank you.
So today, let's start by thinking about a typical course of treatment for a person who has newly diagnosed disease. And you and I see many of these patients in our Thursday glomerular disease and vasculitis clinic. So imagine then you have a person, a stylized one of our patients, who walks in and has kidney disease and perhaps lung disease, and it's an aggressive process. How would you start therapy? What would you do?
So the classic approach to starting therapy for an aggressive form of vasculitis involving the lung and kidney or the kidney alone typically starts with what we call an induction phase of treatment. The induction phase of treatment usually includes using relatively large doses of corticosteroids by vein and then by mouth.
That would be pulsemedrol or methylprednisolone by vein and oral prednisone, or if you're listening from Europe, prednisolone.
That's correct. And how much of the intravenous methylprednisolone is given depends from center to center or from continent to continent. And the dose and the length of treatment of prednisone is also to some degree variable from center to center, and certainly is a focus of ongoing research. But the important thing that we have learned over the years is that corticosteroids alone are not enough, and typically patients are given other immunosuppressant medications. Traditionally, the drug that has made the biggest impact on patient outcomes and survival has been cyclophosphamide, and that can be given either by mouth daily or by vein. And more recently, over the last several years, rituximab has been introduced as an option for the induction phase of treatment of vasculitis.
Who would you use a cyclophosphamide on? In what patient would you start with rituximab? And then I guess there's some patients in whom one might consider both right off the bat.
Rituximab has been introduced as an option several years ago, and it has been pushed to the forefront by a large randomized control trial called the RAVE trial, where patients with ANCA vasculitis were randomized to a treatment of rituximab versus the more traditional approach of using cyclophosphamide. That trial showed that there was really no inferiority of the rituximab approach compared to cyclophosphamide, and has really promoted the use of this medication for induction treatment. It is important to remember how the patients were selected to participate in that trial. Most significantly, that trial has excluded patients with very severe kidney disease, very severe kidney failure, or patients who had very severe lung involvement to the point where they were, for example, in an intensive care unit needing respiratory support. So, in general, our approach has been to offer rituximab in patients with relatively mild to moderate severity of disease. The data for its use alone in patients with very severe disease, either very severe pulmonary disease or very severe kidney disease, is just not yet available. And so,
by severe, you're talking about individuals who would have a rapid decline in kidney function, or
to the point that they need dialysis,
or even somebody who has milder disease that is advancing in front of your nose.
And as you mentioned earlier, sometimes when we start the treatment and the patient who's very severely ill and has received a first dose of cyclophosphamide and is really not improving fast enough clinically and not stabilizing enough clinically, we have been in situations where we have given both medications in sequence. The other arm of treatment that is considered in those cases is called plasmapheresis, where the patient's blood is run through a filter, so to speak, to remove the offending autoantibodies that drive the inflammation.
The ANCA themselves. The idea then is in those individuals who you need to have the medicines to work promptly, cyclophosphamide, still the drug of choice, rituximab, can take 2 or 3 months to fully work. And so if you need to have a drug work more quickly in addition to steroids or glucocorticoids, then in fact cyclophosphamide may be better. But for a large number of patients, rituximab is excellent induction therapy.
That's correct.
If a patient is feeling nervous about getting their first treatment, this is an infusion, it's an infusion of a what's called a biologic drug, what do you tell a patient who's anxious about their first dose to make them feel better? And what kind of side effects do you describe?
The immense majority of patients really tolerate rituximab infusions very well. The thing that we worry the most about is that in a very small minority of patients, well less than 10%, there can be an allergic reaction to the first dose. So what we do use routinely is the patient receives their first dose in a monitored setting. They receive intravenous methylprednisolone dose to decrease the risk of an allergic reaction, and other medications such as diphenhydramine or an antihistamine medication. So if this is really a very sick patient who's in the hospital already receiving their first dose, these things are going to be done automatically. If the patient is not hospitalized and they would receive their first dose in an infusion center, receive these medications to decrease the risk of an allergic reaction. And our nursing staff is very well experienced in doing these medications, and they monitor the patient very carefully. There's a careful protocol to start the dose slowly, and the patient is monitored every 15, 20 minutes. The rate of infusion is increased progressively. The patient is monitored for a little while after the infusion is completed. So we take this very seriously, but by and large, patients really feel very little side effects from that first dose.
And usually if they're developing a reaction, we can just slow down the rate of administration. That said, though, the side effects of rituximab short-term and long-term are like any other immunosuppressive drug. Every single trial that it's been compared to, the adverse events are equivalent to oral cyclophosphamide or azathioprine.
In terms of the risk of infections, this is common to pretty much across the board all immunosuppressants. In the very short term, the difference in side effects between rituximab and cyclophosphamide is more likely to cause nausea and vomiting for a day or two after an intravenous infusions, and that's quite uncommon with rituximab.
How do you pick the dose? What dose do you end up using?
That's a good question. The traditional dose of rituximab was inherited from the oncology, the cancer treatment realm, where the dose that was classically used was 375 milligrams per meter square body surface area weekly for four consecutive weeks. And the RAVE trial that I mentioned before used that approach. As we have gained more experience using this medication, we have moved towards a simpler protocol where we give two doses 2 weeks apart. I have never seen a trial that compares one dose to the other. The two doses 2 weeks apart is just easier and more convenient for the patient. So we are generally following that.
And the
approach.
Side effects of one is really no different than the side effects of the other.
Yeah.
When somebody's had an adverse event or has had a reaction to the infusion, does that mean they're going to have a reaction the next go around, or does it really mean that the dose should be or the drug should be infused more slowly next time around?
It depends a little bit on the severity of the reaction. Certainly, if it is a convincing allergic reaction, we avoid using the medication altogether again. If it is a very mild reaction that went away by slowing the rate of infusion and allowed the patient to complete their treatment, I don't think that this would be a reason to give up on that approach or that treatment approach altogether. Certainly somebody who's had hives or more serious allergic reaction, I would shy away from using the medication again.
If you go forward for several months, these patients are typically on tapering doses of prednisone or prednisolone over 12, 16 weeks or so, and then the drug can be tapered down, if not off. In contrast, if you have somebody who's been given cyclophosphamide, you have to repeat the dose of cyclophosphamide if it's given by vein in about a month or perhaps less, and then perhaps again at month three. The rituximab treatment, you hope, has an effect that doesn't require another round of Rituxan within those first 4 to 6 months.
That's correct. The big question right now is what is the frequency of dosing of rituximab in the more long-term or maintenance phase of treatment of the disease. Again, in the last couple of years, we are learning to see if we can use rituximab for maintenance treatment of vasculitis. And there are a couple of protocols that are being investigated. One of them that has been studied in a large study in France has used a dose every 6 months. There is an ongoing trial across all continents where they're recommending a dose every 4 months or studying a dose every 4 months. But your point is very well taken. Classically, the course of cyclophosphamide required treatment for anywhere 3 to 6 months, whereas with rituximab, ideally we can just do the induction dose. And that dose appears to inhibit or deplete the target lymphocytes for anywhere from 6 to 12 months.
The way of determining then if rituximab has worked, at least working with respect to getting rid of circulating B lymphocytes or what are called CD19 or CD20 lymphocytes, is a blood test, right?
It is a blood test. What that blood test tells us is that the target lymphocytes have been depleted by rituximab. There is a very tiny minority of patients who just don't deplete in response to the medication. And one of the research questions that are ongoing now clinically is whether we can use that blood test to determine when we should redose rituximab in the future for maintenance therapy. That question is not fully answered yet.
All B lymphocytes are not the same. There are some B lymphocytes that are destined to become antibody-producing plasmablasts and plasma cells. Others are regulatory B cells, B lymphocytes that you would like to have control the immune response. Rituximab gets rid of all kinds of B cells. You'd really like the B regulatory cells if you could measure them to return and repopulate and the potentially harmful B lymphocytes stay away.
And that is also a question that we have addressed in a small, relatively small number of patients, but are looking forward to investigating more formally whether there are certain B cell phenotypes or types of B cells that can help us anticipate which patients are more likely to have a relapse and need further immunosuppressive therapy, and differentiate these patients from patients who are less likely to relapse and maybe perhaps be able to be followed expectantly without continued long-term immunosuppression.
What do you do when a patient is given rituximab and their disease just is not getting better by month one or two, or even if you're patient by month three? So you're sitting there in the clinic with a patient and it's 12 weeks into the course of their disease and it's clear they still have very active disease.
This is a tough situation. If the patient is clearly not getting better or, heaven forbid, are getting worse, then we would intervene with an additional medication. The combination of rituximab and cyclophosphamide has been used together, and in fact, in the oncology world, they are routinely used together. But also in the vasculitis world, there has been a small study called RituxVas, which has used a combination of rituximab and cyclophosphamide. So for patients who are failing to improve or are having more severe symptom, we would introduce medication number two. If it's cyclophosphamide, we can add rituximab, and if we've started with rituximab, we can add cyclophosphamide. And the other possibility is thinking about introducing plasmapheresis again to remove the offending ANCA antibodies from the circulation.
By and large, most patients end up doing remarkably well, whether they're treated initially with cyclophosphamide or rituximab. Fully 93% of patients end up getting into remission by month four, five, or six. And then the maintenance question that you've already addressed is the real active question. What should a patient expect with respect to adverse side effects within those first 6 months, whether they've gotten cyclophosphamide or they've gotten rituximab?
By far, the biggest concern is the risk of infections. The risk of infections is highest in the first 3 to 6 months, certainly with cyclophosphamide. And that may actually be driven as much by the dose of corticosteroids in addition to rituximab or cyclophosphamide. And this is the one take-home message that the patients should keep in mind, which is they are now unable to fight infections normally. And if they do develop symptoms suggestive of bronchitis or pneumonia or severe headache or fever or urinary tract infection, they should seek immediate attention so we can identify and treat the infection as promptly as possible.
When they're garden variety infections, most of the time, garden variety meaning common bacterial and viral infections.
There are common bacterial infections. In our retrospective analysis, the most common infection is an pneumonia, and the most common offending agent is Staphylococcus, of the Staphylococcus species. But there are also rare or uncommon atypical infections that we occasionally encounter.
But prednisone, or as you point out, corticosteroids, are probably just as involved in creating this basis for this immunosuppression and infection risk as either the cyclophosphamide or the rituximab. As a matter of fact, trying to stop the prednisone, hopefully by week 16 or certainly by month 6, is an important way of decreasing that risk of infection.
That's correct, and we are also finding out that the very high doses up front could be contributing to this increased risk of infections and other complications that we see with corticosteroids. So corticosteroids are wonderful anti-inflammatory drugs. They work very fast. They quell this inflammation that we see up front very fast, and frequently the patient feels much better after the first few doses of corticosteroids. They have an ugly flip side, which is risk of infections, of diabetes, fluid retention,
cataracts,
bone loss. So this is another field where the vasculitis and glomerulonephritis community is putting a lot of effort to try to find the right balance between the dose that's going to give us as much benefit while minimizing the risk of adverse events in the short and long run.
Let's talk for a moment about the cost of these treatments. They're both financial costs and then they're personal costs of individuals not being able to work. Rituximab, as the infusion, is an expensive medication, which may be different depending upon insurance plans, but there is a real out-of-pocket cost for the copay for this biological drug.
So rituximab is now FDA-approved for this indication, and that has really, thankfully, given a lot of patients access to it through their insurance. But as you pointed out, the copay can be very substantial, and the out-of-pocket expense to a patient can be very substantial, to the point where some patients just can't afford even just the copay.
And that's something that should be a conversation with the patient and their doctor. What should I expect
ahead
with respect
of time,
to this medication cost? Right.
We pay close attention to this because we don't want the patient to be blindsided by a big bill that they can't afford paying. But I think you've alluded to another cost, which is being able to come for 2 infusions instead of 6 over a period of 6 months is also a benefit in terms of time away from work and the loss of income during those days. And also, if a patient doesn't tolerate a medication well, there's added loss of income from days when they're not feeling well enough to go work. So these are factors that come into the decision of pursuing one treatment versus the other based on what the patient is tolerating best.
And there's another very effective remission maintenance drug, equally effective for the most part to rituximab for maintenance, and that would be azathioprine.
Azathioprine is a medication that's taken daily by mouth. Again, the immense majority of patients have very few adverse events, if any, and does not require an infusion and is very well tolerated. There is one study that has been published last year that suggested that maybe every 6 month doses of rituximab may have an advantage over azathioprine. This study needs to be confirmed and is being studied in another clinical trial that is currently ongoing called the Ritazaram trial. So we'll have either confirmation or refuting of these original data.
The first study that was done in Paris largely had patients with one of the ANCA types, proteinase 3 ANCA, and very, very, very few patients with myeloperoxidase ANCA. So we don't know the best remission maintenance in that population.
And that is even more true in the sense that we have learned in the past that patients with proteinase 3 ANCA have a higher risk of relapse. So they may need more immunosuppression, whereas patients with myeloperoxidase ANCA who may have a lower rate of relapses may not need as much immunosuppression in the maintenance phase.
And so that begs the question of when do you stop therapy? If you stop therapy, how do you make sure that you would pick up an early relapse?
So that's really a fundamental question that is at the forefront of our minds. It's easy to start treatment. It's very difficult to know when to stop. What our approach has been over the years is if the patient has really done very well and has absolutely no signs or symptoms suggestive of active disease after a semi-arbitrary period of time of a year or so, we then try to follow the patient by minimizing immunosuppressing, getting them off the immunosuppression. At that point, it becomes very important for the physician and the patient to report and call if they think that they might have symptoms that could be signs of recurrent disease. And the patients themselves become actually better than the physicians in sensing early signs of disease relapse. In our experience, because the patients become attuned to their body and sense early signs of relapse, we tend to catch those relapses early and hopefully nip it in the bud, so to speak.
Interestingly, we've had patients who've been off of any medicines for over 5 years and have done remarkably well. That's not to say that they have no chance of relapsing, but the relapses seem to be turned around very quickly within 30 days, just based on the observation that you just made. Are there fun new drugs coming out on the horizon?
There are different immunosuppressants that are being explored. One new approach, which is really a little bit different than what we had done so far, targets the activation of the inflammatory pathway called the complement pathway of inflammation. And there are a couple of drugs. One of them is being actively studied that in a limited, targeted way is capable of, or we think is capable of, decreasing this inflammatory pathway, which we think contributes to the vasculitis damage by recruiting more white cells to the site of inflammation.
At least in animal studies, it's worked very well, and in a few humans, it's already seemed perhaps to have some kind of a response.
Early phase trials are encouraging results, and a larger phase 3 trial is anticipated.
If an ANCA vasculitis patient is looking for more information, you can find it on the UNC Kidney Center website. A tremendous resource and support for patients is, of course, the Vasculitis Foundation. That foundation hosts conferences and symposiums, and patients can visit the Vasculitis Foundation website, Facebook page, and watch patient education videos and webinars on the Vasculitis Foundation YouTube. You should know that Dr. Nachman is actually on one of those YouTube videos trying to have people understand their laboratory findings. Patrick, thanks so much for spending time with me today.
Thank you very much.